One, two, three. This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. And every week here we talk about how to love yourself, others, and a higher nature, how to improve your life and your relationships and your self-esteem and your emotional intelligence. And today we have a really great guest. I'm very happy to have this guest on today. This gentleman here is Hank Weisinger, an influential psychologist, a two-time New York best-selling author, Emotional Intelligence at Work, Anger Workout Book, Nobody's Perfect, The Power of Positive Criticism, and his latest one, Performing Under Pressure, which we're going to talk about. And he spent over 30 years helping Fortune 500 companies, business schools, government agencies, and individuals find success in many different areas. So I'm really excited to have you, Hank. How are you doing today?
Good, and I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, that's great. I do have to ask you for some help, though. You know, this weekend, I was actually looking through your materials, and all of a sudden, I got your book in the mail, and I felt a little bit of anxiety because I thought, can I get all this done? I had a lot of other things to do. So I started reading your book, and then, of course, I said to myself, wait a minute, one of your key points is have fun. So I said, okay, I'm going to have fun. I'm going to learn this material and enjoy it, and I actually did. So based on that, Hank, was I under pressure or was I under stress?
Well, you put yourself under time pressure. As soon as you made the statement, can I get it all done? You had a deadline in your mind.
Yes.
And one of the things that I found is that nobody does better under pressure, and nobody does better under a sense of time pressure. You know, you have many people who think, oh, I'll wait till the last minute because that's when I'm going to be most creative. I work best under a deadline.
Exactly.
Actually, that is a myth. You might get more done, but the quality turns out to be very poor compared to when you give yourself a lot of time.
Yeah, that makes
and,
sense.
And you're at the point, you know, stress and pressure, most people treat them the same. And as a result, they end up leading their life on 24/7 high alert because every stressful moment, they make a do or die situation.
Exactly. And I think you, if I'm correct, you define stress as when your demand exceeds your ability, at least you perceive that to be the case. And pressure, you have that plus what you call a do or die, where you have to perform well. And also have what we call a high self-observer in attribution theory, where you basically are self-conscious and you feel kind of like that people are watching you or that you're watching yourself to do well. So how do you see that distinction? Do you feel that that pressure is something different than stress?
Yes, most people will experience stress, the occurrence of it. Just like you said, when you perceive that there are a lot of demands made upon you and you don't have the resources to respond. For example, one that people in Los Angeles can relate to.
Yes.
Too many bills, not enough cash. And that will create financial stress.
Yes.
Now, so that's when you experience stress. So a student who is taking 10 courses, feels his or her curriculum is stressful, too many demands, they don't have enough resources. Pressure is different. Pressure occurs in a situation that is important to you and the outcome is dependent on your performance. So for the Dodger game tonight, that would be a pressure situation for Kershaw. He's in an important situation. We don't know what the outcome is, and it is to a large degree dependent on his performance. You know, if we knew what the outcome was, there'd be no pressure.
Dodgers win, right?
Right. If a student is guaranteed an A in a class, there is no pressure when they take that last exam.
So if you were to say too many cars and too little space in L.A. traffic is maybe stress, but I'm running late to my job interview, which I really want to get. Would you call that pressure?
Now it becomes a pressure moment. Look, I used to live in L.A.
Yeah, you told me that. Yeah, you did. You used to. Now you're in the beautiful New York where nobody drives.
Right.
Am I correct?
So I remember times where it would be bumper-to-bumper traffic.
Yes.
But the reality is, if I was not in a rush, if I didn't have to be anywhere, at worst, it would be a stressful situation because maybe of the noise and so on, you're in the traffic. But I'm not feeling any pressure. I can just relax and listen to the radio.
Yeah, put on Love University podcast, right? Get some knowledge on the way to the road.
Exactly.
Now, the idea here, Hank, this is interesting where we kind of like see a blend of these things. because there's what we call the time crunch, perfectionistic pressure. Let's say that, you know, we have professional people or people that work hard and they're, you know, they want to be the best they can be. So they put a lot of high pressure on themselves to be the best. And I guess that can become pressure the way you're defining it. But isn't most pressure self-induced? You could say that in our society, you know, we're not facing saber-toothed tigers anymore, but it's basically we want to get, 100% on the score, whatever it is, on a report. So how do we deal with that?
In some situations, you know, you're raising an important point, and that is there are some situations in which we experience pressure in the moment.
Yes.
Giving a presentation, audition, a sporting event. But there is another, and I actually call this pressure anxiety. And I actually found it very common in LA because it is such a competitive environment. And what pressure anxiety is, the perpetual feeling that you have to produce. And see, that's the pressure, the demand. You have to.
Right.
And the anxiety is, how much longer can I do this? How much longer can I be successful?
Yes.
And I will tell you that some people, that's the feeling that wakes them up. Mm. And it's the thought that keeps them from getting a good night's sleep. And one of the reasons for it is the idea that people are competitive. They try to be number one. That's a losing scenario.
Right.
You know, if your goal, for example, in LA is to be the richest person, it's going to be relentless because there's always going to be somebody making more. There's always going to be some better looking.
Exactly.
So I have found that successful people tend to be very competitive. I used to tell people, I know a lot of competitive people. They're very successful. They're so successful that they can see their therapist three times a week.
Exactly. Yeah, it makes us successful too, but it doesn't help them, I guess, if they're too stressful.
Right. So one of the things that I would recommend to listeners as a way of reducing that daily feeling of pressure is, instead of focusing on competition, being better than the other person, you know, it's beating the Joneses. It's more than keeping up with the Joneses.
Right.
So just focus on being the best you can be.
Ah, I like that.
That's a big difference.
Yeah, it takes the pressure off. By the way, Hank, you talk pretty slow. You're one of the slowest talking New Yorkers I've ever seen. How did you get that slow talking?
By increasing my awareness that I want people to be able to understand what I am saying. You know, it's funny you say that, because I used to get criticized for speaking too quickly.
Yeah.
I actually have, when I was teaching at UCLA, I would put on the podium or the desk in front of me, I'd put a note that would say, speak slowly, as a reminder. That would help me increase my awareness.
I like that. So awareness is an important aspect of the pressure reduction from what you're saying in the many of your things here. Now, one thing I want to get into, this is really interesting, is what you call the myths about pressure. And apparently there's some myths that people think, when it comes to the idea of pressure. So I'm going to ask you these things, Hank, and you tell me, what do you think, is it true or false? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So, Hank, I believe that I'm more productive and creative under pressure because I can do more work and I'm more creative because I need that stimulus. Is that true or false?
That is false. Creativity is actually impaired by pressure. Yeah. And you, as I said earlier, you can get more done, but the quality decreases.
Yes. So I think even said people think they do better, but they really don't.
That. Yeah, so they don't, you know, it's the students who are listening. Don't wait until the last minute thinking that you're going to do better, and pull all-nighter. You might get your paper finished, but it's not going to be as good as if you give yourself the right amount of time to write it effectively.
That makes sense. Now, here's one that I'm really interested in. It says pressure can get you off your butt, shall we say, you know, to get you to work. Let's say you're procrastinating and all that. And maybe aren't there people, let's say you have a, 25-year-old kid that's in a cloud of smoke in the house and eating bonbons and doesn't want to work and they're living in your house. What do you say to this young man?
Well, there's many things that you could say, but the stress sometimes can, this is one of the differences between stress and pressure.
Right.
Stress can make a person more productive, you know, you make the kid more productive by throwing more demands his or her way. Pressure is never helpful. The goal of pressure is to get rid of you. What happens to people in a competitive business if they can't handle the pressure? What happens to a team if they can't handle the pressure? They're out. What happens to a student who can't handle the pressure at a university? They're out. So while stress can sometimes be motivating, pressure always works against you. I want people to think of it as a villain in their lives. It's out to get you.
Right. But telling your kid they're in their 20s, they have to get a job or move out, is that stress or pressure?
Well, I would say that the parent is putting pressure on the child to do something. But I think I think every parent knows that's not an effective strategy. There are better ways that are, as you are well aware of helping your kid.
Sure. But you're not advocating a laissez-faire world where everyone lies around the house, you know, with no pressure and you kind of sleeps all day and watches TV. Or do you think that's important?
No, I think it's important for the parent or the student or the working person to find out what is of interest to them.
Right.
And if you find out and you know what is of interest to you, that will become self-motivating. Many people lie around the house because they have no interest or they don't know what they want to be doing.
Right. They're apathetic, they say.
Exactly.
I see. Now, here's an interesting one. Now, I think you're a sports fan like I am, and I used to play some tennis, and my son actually plays basketball, college, and a little bit semi-pro. So the idea that there are what we call clutch performers, and I guess you can say in business and other areas, you know, in the baseball, I think you mentioned Mixer October, Reggie Jackson and Big Shot Rob. You remember this guy, Robert Horry? They always seem to do great in these pressure playoff situations in basketball and other sports. So is that true? Are there these clutch performers that are just amazing at this?
Do you remember the movie The Natural with Robert Redford?
Yes.
And do you remember the last scene where he comes up, the game is on the line?
Yes.
How many times have we seen this? And all of a sudden, he's coming up and it's a 3-2 count and he hits the game-winning home run and everybody says, he's the greatest.
Exactly.
In reality, in the book
by
the same title, he struck out. That's reality.
Right.
In other words, there is no such thing as clutch. The edge in sports, I mean, we saw this last night. How many clutch situations? Why didn't any of the players get the hit? More often than not, strike out.
Right.
Tom Brady is the best quarterback all the time. So naturally, in some moments, those pressure moments, he's going to do better. You know, we remember the touchdown that he throws in the last second, but we forget about the touchdown he threw to end the first half. You know, the interception that he in the first. So there is no such thing as clutch players. There are clutch hits, but not clutch.
Right. Because I think you're saying that you basically are as good as you are in every situation. You know, if you're a great player when there's no pressure, you probably will be a great player when there's pressure, more or less, if you can manage the pressure.
Exactly.
And if you're not a good player, you're probably not going to be great under pressure necessarily either, just by being there.
So the C student is never going to rise to the occasion and get 1,600 on their SATs,
exactly,
unless they cheat.
Oh.
Just like, but many times the A student will perform below his or her capabilities.
Right. I think you call it choking in your book.
That's right. Choking is a reality. Clutch is a myth.
I see. And you do have some statistics in your book. You talk about, like, you look at the baseball players, they have the clutch hits, and, they don't really perform that way every year. And even in free throws, you say that typically basketball players do worse in playoffs on the average. I think the percentages are low. But I did find a couple of things that are interesting. There's one study that in the last 20 years, they looked at postseason basketball players. And there are some that actually improved their performance in the playoffs. Dirk Nowitzki scored more points, rebounds, and assists. And even a guy named Rajon Rondo. So there are a few players that actually improved their performance in the playoffs statistically over a large period of time. How do you explain that?
Well, one time I was giving a presentation, and a financial advisor, I was making the point that competition brings out the worst in people, not the best.
Right.
So she said to me, well, how do you explain the fact that when I look at the other financial advisors and see how they're performing, I become more competitive and I do better?
Right.
And I'll say it's the same thing I said to her as what I'd say to the athlete. Then you weren't trying your hardest the other time.
Oh. You think Dirk Nowitzki wasn't trying as hard in the regular season?
I think he was playing good enough to win. Ah. Not necessarily his best. You know what? There are very few athletes. Derek Jeter was one, for example. Right. Where if he would hit a ground ball back to the pitcher, he would sprint to first base.
Right.
There are very few athletes who can do their best 100% all of the time. It's too hard.
Really? So you think they're conserving their energy, you think, for the playoffs and that kind of thing, or saving themselves?
Absolutely. How many times did you see the coach of San Antonio take out his players and give them a rest?
Right.
Because we're at the playoffs. We've already won the division. Why should they kill themselves?
Yeah.
That's like a student who has locked in an A. They're not going to kill themselves for the last exam. Mm. No matter what they get, they're getting an A.
Yeah, that's a good point. I never thought of it that way. Cause I always thought Dirk Nowitzki is a great player pretty much, so he's even greater in the playoffs. But you're saying he's not as great as he could be in the regular season.
He's not as great as LeBron, is he?
Nope.
Yeah, because LeBron does his best every game.
That makes sense.
That is the difference. And that's the true elite athlete. Uh-huh. And that's why there's few of them.
Right.
Because it's that hard to do your best every single time.
That means you're betting on the Knicks this year to win the championship, right?
No, please.
I thought I'd get you with that one, right?
You got me. It hurts.
Now, Hank, how about truths about pressure? Those were myths. But tell me if this is true or not about pressure. Pressure makes you more defensive in the way you respond to people's, like criticism, things like that. Is that true or false?
That is true. Pressure has a very, when people experience pressure in their relationship, as in the form of one partner pressuring another to act or do certain things, the relationship suffers. It makes each person tense.
Yes.
And less receptive to what their partner is saying.
Right. Because you mentioned Gottman's research on marriage. Is that one of the examples where people talk to each other in a very tense kind of tone of voice or something?
Yeah. And I found what was interesting. For those who don't know, John Gottman runs what he calls the Love Lab of University of Washington. And one of his interesting findings is he found that the number one predictor of why a couple will break up or why they will stay is their ability to handle pressure in the marriage. I thought that was a very interesting finding.
That is very interesting.
As a clinician, not surprising.
That makes sense. Okay, how about this one, Hank? You take less risk if you are under pressure.
Sometimes that is true. You take less risk because your judgment many times is impaired under pressure. Well, one of the things that pressure does is it downgrades our cognitive skills, our judgment, our decision-making, our attention, our memory. So think of how many tasks that you have to do that are dependent on those skills.
And if you're a stockbroker in a down market, are you going to take less or more risk if the market's going down?
Well, it will depend on what your goal is. If you feel that your job is on the line unless you make money for your clients, you are apt to be take some risk that might not be in your client's best best interest.
Right. The other thing, this is one that I found really fascinating. If it's true, it's a little bit sad, too. If you're under pressure, you have less ethics and less morality. Is that true?
I think all you have to do is look at what is going on in the real world as we speak, whether it's the political world or whether it's in the corporate world.
Right.
How many times have you heard people say, the pressure made me do it. I was under pressure.
Yes.
I mean, executives get themselves in trouble, make bad decisions when they are under pressure. People steal when they're under pressure. Yeah. They lie when they are under pressure.
Right. Yeah, you said something like A students cheat under pressure. But here's the one that really got to me. You said there was a study with seminary students who were about to give a sermon on the Good Samaritan, helping someone who is injured. And then you told them they were late. And because they were late, they actually walked over a homeless guy. 10% of them stopped to help the homeless guy. And isn't that kind of amazing?
Exactly. It shows what happens in terms of we stop being a good person. When we're under time pressure, we become rushed and we forget about other things.
Right. But you think that, you know, being raised in the, you know, the humanitarian kind of, you know, spiritual market, they would be able to, you know, help the homeless guy.
That's what was so powerful about the experiment and about the force. You really have to think in terms of pressure as a force. You know, we're talking about it psychologically.
Right.
But if you take your hand, one hand, you put it on your other hand and you squeeze it, that's
right.
the physical feeling of pressure.
Yes.
And that's how it feels, like we're being squeezed.
Hmm. That's hard. Now, I remember, I don't know if you remember, Hank, when there were no cell phones, there was no internet. You didn't have to check your phone every 5 minutes. You didn't have to check your email. I would say those are less pressureless times in some ways. Well, how do we handle pressure in our society where you do have to check your cell phone every 5 minutes or your email? And you feel kind of pressure if you don't.
You know, I remember when people first started getting Blackberries, and I was doing so much traveling and playing with land, and everybody would take out their Blackberry.
Right.
And I was sad for these people that they were so addicted. Then when I got a Blackberry, within a week, I became one of those people. And I think one of the things that you have to do is train yourself not to look at your phone every 5 minutes. See,
right.
everybody's on call. That's the problem.
Yeah, you feel I hate that. That's kind of like tough, huh?
And I mean, think of you text somebody, and if you don't get a response in a minute, you get upset.
Yeah.
How many
if you want to go out with somebody that they say, oh, you don't care about me, you know, bye.
That's right. You go into a restaurant on a Saturday and you'll see everybody has their cell phone on their table.
Exactly.
You know, one of the things I learned is like when I go out on a Saturday night, I turn off my cell phone because I think, who's going to call me? I don't need it. So one strategy that can help people is to sort of get away from the constant technology that they are using. Obviously, in the business world, you have to check your messages.
Yes.
But the frequency that we do it on is over the top, and I think it makes people more anxious.
Exactly. Well, I think someone said that it's kind of like the lottery mentality. That you think, you know, Lonnie Anderson is going to call you up on a date or, you know, win the lottery or something if you don't get that email or that phone call. So, you know, that would be kind of tough, right? You don't want to miss that, do you?
Well, that is for, if people are thinking that, then they need to go see a psychiatrist and get their meds.
Yeah, even Reggie's laughing. My producer, he's laughing like crazy. That's kind of funny. Why is it so funny, Reggie, that you're laughing like crazy?
Well, it's just that whole concept. Like everybody thinks they're going to, they're one email away from winning the lottery. You know, it's just statistically probable. You know, but it's going to be me for some reason. Oh yeah, it's going to be me.
Right. So it's a fantasy people have.
Well, I find because I live in Connecticut now that when I moved out of Los Angeles,
yes. Now, you don't like Los Angeles, do you, Hank? You keep bashing us a little bit. Is that true?
My friends, my closest friends are still there, and I like to visit, but no, I do not. I do not miss. I actually like the Northeast.
Oh, more relaxed out there, huh? More better pace?
It's a faster pace, actually, but I'm more. It's less competitive in many ways.
Who
really cares what kind of car you're driving here?
I see what you're saying. Now let's talk about some pressure traps, Hank, what you call pressure traps. But, I mean, most people think this is actually good. So let's say I support my child. Say, honey, you know, if you do well in school, I love you because you're smart. Is that good or bad?
That's bad.
Okay, why is it bad to give you support to your children or to your friends?
If you're giving support, then it would be I love you no matter how you do.
So unconditional support is better.
A lot of parents will try to give an incentive. Okay, so listen, if you do well, then you're going to get that new a new iPhone or I'll get you a car. So as soon as the parent is out and I have my test tomorrow, yes. I want that car. So you know what? I think I'll make a little crib sheet just to help me.
Mm.
See, why do smart kids cheat?
Ah.
If they're so smart, why do they cheat?
Yes, that's true.
It's because of the pressure. Every major high school has had cheating scandals.
That's true. And then you talk about incentives, but you say that people who get money on research tasks do actually do slower or they do more poorly. But isn't that contradictory that you should say, well, if I get a little more money, a bonus, I'm going to work harder and better. Isn't that true or no?
Sometimes it is true up to a point. Do you think that any of the players in a World Series game are playing harder because they're going to get a World Series bonus?
I don't know. Are there some like that or not?
I doubt it. They're playing because they're of their own competitive nature and because it's fun to fun to win.
Right.
Listen, incentives can be good and incentives can be bad. But rather than for a person to focus on the incentives of always getting things, it's better for a person to focus on their own interest and what is meaningful to them. And then they will be motivated and they will feel less pressure.
That makes sense. You talk about mastery versus performance goals. Like mastery, you know, being the best you can be internally versus, like you said, you know, trying to be the competition. So you feel that's a little better. Except that you said in sports, though, it is a zero-sum kind of thing, right? One person loses and wins.
You know, what's interesting is when I was doing this book, I noticed it's like I looked at a lot of sports psychology research.
Right.
And what I found is that sports psychologists tend to focus on, quote, elite performance. I did not study elite performance. I studied the construct of pressure. And by studying that construct, that's what gave me a lot of revelations. See, what sports psychologists don't want to say is that you can do your best and still lose. Your best might not be good enough.
Yes.
But there is a difference between doing your best in losing versus losing because you didn't do your best because you choked. That's when athletes or students or anybody feels upset because it wasn't their talent that took them out of the game. It was coming to the force of pressure.
So doing your best and losing can be okay, you're saying, for people.
I'm saying it's in every one-on-one competition, it's true for 50% of the people.
That's true. And then that drive for
winning. That's when you hear the person say, look, I played great, and I give my opponent credit.
Right. Except for Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan, they said he was so competitive, he hated to lose, and he would even break things or something. Is that a different kind of mindset?
I have seen many athletes I find in professional sports, undetected, have anger management problems.
Really? Wow.
And emotional regulation problems. Yeah, for example, how does it help your team if you commit a personal foul by pushing another player?
Right.
How does that help?
Right.
I remember the great John Elway one time didn't get a first down. He spiked the football, cost him another 5 yards, and he hurt his team.
That's a good point. Yeah. Unless you think it's a motivator, some coaches get thrown out of the game just to motivate their team. But does that work or not too much?
I would say sometimes it works. You know, the great Bobby Knight, who used to be coach of Indiana, became known for one time picking up a chair and throwing it across the court.
Exactly.
Now, during the filming of Anger Management, in which my daughter had a little cameo appearance, I got to meet Bobby, and I asked him about that. And he said, no. He said, had nothing to do with anger.
Right.
He says, I coached standing up, and some woman on the other side of the court yelled out, Coach, if you're not going to use that chair, throw it over.
You believe that? It sounds like a funny story.
It was a funny story when he told me.
Now, heck, you seem like a very mellow guy. I mean, were you under pressure yourself? How did you even get so interested in this kind of stuff, the whole pressure thing?
You know, it's funny you say that. As I said, when I lived in L.A., I always felt I was under pressure from private schools, you know, the whole thing.
Right.
When I moved back to Connecticut, I was watching a Yankee game. I'm a diehard Yankee fan.
Right.
And I'm watching, and I was getting so frustrated because they would be losing every game.
Right.
Players were always, quote, choking. If I didn't know a lot about anger management, I would have broken my TV set. And then I started to ask myself, why do some people perform well under pressure and others don't?
Right.
And that led me on a journey to read studies and theories. And I dealt with the subject of pressure from a evolutionary perspective. Like, like who invented pressure?
Yes.
Nobody invented it. It's nature's selection mechanism.
Right.
Those who can handle the pressure of a situation, getting away from the predator, for example, right, are the ones who advance. Those who could make the leap over from one mountain cliff to another would survive. That was literally a do or die situation.
Wow. So does that mean all of us on the world today are good under pressure because we survived, our ancestors survived, or not necessarily?
That is correct. So many times, because of our hard wiring, we respond to like taking a test or a presentation as our ancestors did, as a do or die situation.
Right.
You know, when kids come home from school and they say, oh, my life is over, I got a C on the test. And the parents say, oh, stop, you're exaggerating. Your life isn't over, it's just one test. But that parent comes home from work saying the same thing. I call that primal pressure.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also, you mentioned the third variable, you call it biological predisposition for intensity. Some people are maybe even born with a more reactive system. You heard of Kagan's research with infants that some of them have higher heart rates in utero. And then they later turn out to have social phobia. So do you believe in that aspect that some people are born, perhaps?
Yeah, because it's like anxiety disorders.
Yes.
That some people, you know, there's a lot of genetic evidence and hereditary evidence and biological evidence for anxiety. And I would say that how many millions, just think in terms of how many people you've treated that have anxiety disorders.
Right, but are those people lost? I mean, we can't help.
Those people are behind the eight ball in a pressure situation. Because remember, part of pressure is uncertainty.
Right.
So in every pressure moment, there is an element of uncertainty, i.e. anxiety. So that's bad enough. Uh-huh. But if you're going to bring extra anxiety to the situation, then you're really making it hard for yourself.
Right. So you're uncertain and your life depends on it, you know, do or die, like you said. Now you're really having some trouble, right, because of pressure.
That's right.
Now, Hank, let's talk about, let's give people some hope here, because we're getting them kind of a tough picture. You know, we live in a place where there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of problems and we suffer. So let's talk about some solutions. And you have, in your book, you really have a great, by the way, it's very well written. I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
And the content is very rich, very deep, and also entertaining. So it wasn't really boring or anything, like some academic books can be. So really had that. And I think of a couple of things. I think of the Eastern philosophy, you've heard of Taoism and all that, where they talk about effortless effort and, you know, flowing with circumstances as an antidote to pressure. And also, you know, the term, I think you mentioned an anticipatory anxiety, where, let's say you're a stutterer, you fear the stuttering so much that it actually makes you stutter more. And there is a technique called paradoxical intention, where you tell people, hey, be the best stutterer in the world. So you actually practice being the best stutterer, and it takes away the anxiety from that. So I think some of your techniques have maybe some of this underpinnings, I'm wondering.
Absolutely. You know, and as I said, I mean, you're a psychologist, so you are going to appreciate the theoretical underpinnings more than the working person. And to those people, I would say, you know, when you go to see a doctor and he says, take this medicine, very few people say, explain to me why the medicine works.
Right.
And I'm saying the same thing. You don't really need the explanation. The pressure solutions, which you're 22 in the book, are all evidence-based. That means that if you do that, the chances are great that they are going to help you. And there's extended references, so if you want to learn more about the science underlining them, people are free to read them. But I find that necessary.
Exactly. So let's go over a few of these, and you tell me what you think. Number one, see it as a fun challenge instead of like, you know, something do or die. So why is that good to befriend the fun challenge?
You have to befriend. The biggest difference between people who perform close to their capabilities under pressure and those who collapse is how you perceive the situation.
Right.
Do you perceive it as threatening, or do you perceive it as an opportunity or as a challenge or something that is fun? If you perceive it in the latter, then you can approach the situation with confidence, not with trepidation.
Yes.
It's very hard to make your best effort if you perceive that you're going into a threatening, hostile type of situation.
Right.
And if you look at random quotes of athletes that you pick up, even if you listen to the interviews in the baseball playoff, over and over you will hear them saying, oh, this is so much fun. This is like a great opportunity. It's what I always wanted. nobody is seeing it as threatening. Tommy Lasorda, a former manager of the Dodgers, said that players thinking about pressure, they're thinking about losing.
Yeah, exactly. But now one thing, now someone may argue something like this. Isn't that, Hank, kind of tricking your mind? Because let's say you have to go to a divorce proceeding in front of the judge, and that's not fun. That's not, you know, anything good. Isn't that also kind of a difficult, you know, kind of almost it's an attack against you?
I would say it's an opportunity to start to correct your life. that would be how I would be framing it to a patient.
Okay, so someone who goes to a court proceeding, they're going to hate it, but you said there's something to learn from that.
That's right. This is an opportunity. The bottom line is you have to deal with the situation.
Yes.
So it's in your best interest always to be positive, to always have a positive attitude.
I agree with that. Yeah. Optimism is very important.
Crucial. And you know what I learned? Unless you really read the academic research on optimism, it's hard to accept that it is so powerful as a force in making our lives better.
Yes.
It is a tremendous edge to be optimistic.
Exactly. I want to get into that a little more, but one thing that you mentioned here that's interesting is you talk about multiple opportunities, and this isn't the last time you're going to have this thing. And at this point, I want to bring in my producer, Reggie. Hi, Reggie.
Hi.
Now, Reggie is a great young man. He's very shy. He's never really had a real relationship before. So I gave him a challenge. I say, Reggie, if you find a date, I'll pay for it. You know, $100 date or something really nice. But Reggie's had a hard time because he doesn't go out much. He doesn't have many opportunities. So how do we help Reggie in this case?
Well, first, let me start off by telling a story that Reggie will be amused by.
Yes.
I was giving a presentation one time in Canada to a bunch of financial advisors. There must have been about 500 in the room. So one guy in his early 20s gets up and he says, how do you handle the pressure of calling a girl that you really like and you're calling her for the first time? He said, that's a lot of pressure for me. How do I handle it? Before I could respond, another guy a few years older jumped up and said, just tell yourself there's 1,000 other girls waiting for the same phone call.
Okay.
And everybody laughed. But everybody knew it was true.
Right. So, Reggie, what do you think of that advice? Think of there are 1,000 girls that want to meet you.
That's pretty encouraging.
Multiple opportunities.
Okay.
The one way that Reggie can be helped, it's the same thing that I would tell one of my kids when we moved from California to Connecticut in terms of making friends. I said, look, the worst thing that can happen is if you ask a friend for a play date or whatever, is they can say no. I said, that's the worst thing. And you don't die.
Right. Although it happened to Reggie and his heart was broken a little bit. Tell us about that, Reggie.
Oh, no, that always happens. You know, like I'll approach a girl or whatever and I'll ask them out. I think there might be some kind of rapport. And then I'm like, hey, do you want to go out for coffee or something or whatever? And they'll say no. Sometimes they'll say no, but more often they say, oh, yeah, sure, or whatever. Here's my number or whatever. And then, like, it just ghosts me, you know?
So they never call her back. What do you say, Hank?
I'd say that it's to call again if you like the person and be persistent. Also, look at the expectations that you might have. It's not easy, especially in Los Angeles, to meet somebody. Or I should say, I found in relationships, it's easy to meet somebody, but it's not easy to meet somebody that you like. It's a numbers game when you're meeting people. And not only that, Reggie, I would say that get involved in some activities that you are interested in. And then because that is how you will, A, you'll be enjoying whatever the activity is, and B, you will meet other people, meaning girls, who have the same interests as you do. And that becomes a good starting.
That's great advice. So Reggie, Reggie's going to get that $100 from me pretty soon, I think, on that date. Right, Reggie?
I'm trying.
Now, Dr. Wiseman, you also said,
for Reggie, that let's say reverse that. A girl asks you out. You don't want to hurt her feelings, but you're not attracted to her. You say you'll call, but you never do. So both people do that. Don't take it personally.
That makes sense. Now, you talk also about recalling past successes, but what if Reggie's never had a success? How can he recall what he doesn't have?
Then he can't use that.
Oh, he can't do that?
then he can't, if he hasn't had successes. The idea there is to give yourself a sense of confidence. Yes. You know, I will say that I wrote an article that's for eHarmony. It's on the internet.
Really? Okay.
It's on dating pressure.
Yes.
And what I found, there's different types of pressure when you're going out with somebody for the first time. There is setting pleasure. Where do we go? Mm-hmm. Is it a good environment? There is conversational pressure.
Right.
There is physical pressure, making yourself, you know, you have to look a certain way, or at least you tell yourself that. So do your homework and look that article up on dating pressure. It's online, and you might find it to be helpful.
That's pretty good. And they also say to practice experiencing pressure, so putting yourself under situations, I guess like practicing your speech in front of people, or what would be an example of that? How do we practice pressure?
Well, let's say that you're going to give a presentation tomorrow at work, and you're going to have 30 minutes to give that presentation.
Yes.
When you practice it, give it in 15 minutes.
Ah, okay.
Shorten the time.
I see. Kind of like putting leg weights on your legs if you're training for something, right? To give you that extra hardness.
My son one time, he wanted to test out his presentation on me.
Yes.
Comes in and he says, "All right, Dad, I want you to listen and critique my presentation." I said, "Go ahead." He said, "Turn off the TV." I said, "No." I said, "Are you going to tell your boss to turn off the TV if he has it on in his office?" I said, "It's not bothering me. If it bothers you, that's the problem."
Okay, interesting. So you're making it kind of a little tough so he gets the hang of it, in a sense, right? Like get the exposure. And also, I like the way you summarized it. You said this could be like self-talk. You tell yourself, like, it's a sweet opportunity. I'll get another chance. I've done it before, and I'll do my best. So there are ways we can talk to ourselves to help us with this pressure challenge.
That's right. You know, when I first started teaching at UCLA, I used to get anxious all the time.
Yes.
And the reason I got anxious, I was saying things to myself like, "Oh, I have to do well, otherwise they won't, you know, use me again.
Yes.
And my business won't take off," and so on. Then it got to the point where I started saying to myself, "This is a great opportunity. I'm going to market myself. I'm getting paid. It's going to be fun. I'm educating people."
Exactly.
And I never felt pressure from that point on
to perform. Yeah, so you call it reframing, right? Think of it as a positive, something that's going to help your life and make you succeed. And finally, I think it's time to put on our coat of armor. I don't know if we have any armor here, but you tell me you have four pieces of armor that are psychological people can use for pressure.
That's right. I found that there are four attributes that have evolved with man for the purpose of helping us deal with the challenges that are thrown our way. And those four attributes are confidence, optimism, tenacity, and enthusiasm.
Yes.
And the pressure solutions are microcosms of those four attributes. So when I say to a person, befriend the moment and think positive, that is a microcosm of the concept of confidence. And remember, nobody invented confidence. Nobody invented optimism.
Right.
Just like confidence 500 years ago or 5,000 years ago gave the warrior an edge, it gives some financial advisor or real estate agent an edge today.
Hmm.
Just who would you rather be with? Chief thousands of years ago who said, "Man, we're not going to find any water. We're all going to die." Or the chief who said, "Come on, we'll keep going. I'm sure we're going to find some more."
Interesting. Now, confidence, you also mentioned what's called micro successes. So I guess that's a little success. So let's say, Reggie, you go out and maybe get a smile from a woman or something, you know, something small. You think that would be helpful for Reggie if he can get a little success, a little smile or something?
Because that would be the goal. Micro success means instead of waiting to achieve success, it's like what I would tell my kids. I said, when you go for a job interview, you might not get the job. But if you have a good interview, that's a success, because then it's just a matter of time.
Exactly.
If Reggie goes around, one of the things I would tell him to do is to smile, because when you smile at somebody, automatically they smile back at you. It's called emotional contagion.
Right.
So anytime he smiles at a girl and they smile back, that's a success.
I like that. That's great. So, Reggie, let's say right now you're a Starbucks. Smile and make a little funny joke.
Why did the chicken cross the road?
Why did the chicken cross the road?
To get to the other side.
Hank, I think we need to work with Reggie on this one. So, okay, we need some better jokes, no? Don't you think?
Humor is very important. But you know what's even more important?
What's that?
Being yourself and being authentic.
Okay, even a corny joke can work if he's with himself.
Because when you are yourself, a lot of pressure goes away. Because you're not acting. Have you ever seen these TED Talks?
Yes.
I'm amazed at how many speakers say, they're doing a TED Talk, and they say, oh, I was so nervous and so on. Now, what are they nervous about? See, they're nervous because they think they are performing.
Right.
I don't think I'm performing when I give a presentation. I think I'm just educating people.
That makes sense. Yeah, you're focusing outwardly instead of inwardly. Your external.
You think you're performing. You're doing an act. So this is saying that, Reggie, when you meet a girl, and I tell this to, believe me, it's the age is irrelevant. If you are authentic and if you are just yourself, you increase the chances of, connecting with somebody. Because they want to be themselves. They want to be themselves too.
Right. So, Reggie, you got to practice those chicken and egg jokes that you're talking about. Okay. Now, the optimism also, Hank, you're talking about is important. But you're also saying the only exception is lawyers. Lawyers need to be pessimistic because they can find problems. Are there some people that they just have to be pessimistic and that's the way they make it successful?
We're pessimistic when they get into law school, but they're optimistic. Their optimism is what gets them into law school.
Oh, okay.
You know, I will tell you, Yale University just did a study where it was something like 85% of their law students had mental health issues, a lot of them clinical depression.
That's not good. Are they that way because they went to law school, or are they that way before they went to law school?
Yeah, I think that's characteristic of law school. I was interviewed recently with a lady who does a podcast for lawyers,
right?
And she told me her first semester at Columbia University, she had a straight A average, and the second semester she had clinical depression.
Wow, that's not good at all.
Not good at all.
Exactly. Okay, so tenacity is sticking to your goals, and also enthusiasm. You said we should dance, clap, and laugh a lot.
These are ways of making yourself enthusiastic. So when do you become enthusiastic? Think in terms of your daily life.
Yes.
Most people will become enthusiastic when they become interested in something.
Right.
And two, when they have completed a goal. However, those things don't happen every day.
Right.
So it's very important to know how to make yourself enthusiastic.
But you know, I'm actually naturally enthusiastic. Personally, I always say to people, "Are you excited?" And yeah, I'm just excited about life. Is that like something that's rare among people, or is that something that you find a lot?
Not as much as I would like to find it, but that tells me that you're an optimistic person.
Yes,
because when you're optimistic, enthusiasm is spawned by optimism. If you're enthusiastic, you're optimistic.
Interesting. But you could be, a realistic pessimist, and you're accurate, but you're depressed, or you could be a optimist who's a little bit in the fantasy world, but happy. Which would you choose?
I would choose the being optimistic. You know, the key is you want to be realistically optimistic.
Oh, okay. Somewhere in the middle.
Exactly. And the way you are realistically optimistic is you ask yourself, instead of just saying, oh, I just know something good is going to happen, you're asking yourself, what's the evidence that I'm using?
Amazing.
And so I can be optimistic that I'm going to get an A on this test because I've got, B pluses and A minuses on my other exam. If I've gotten all D's, then I'm being unrealistically optimistic.
That's great. Well, Hank, this has been a lot of fun, and I'm very optimistic that this is a show that people really enjoy because, this is really great content, and it's also very applicable.
Come back and talk about the subjects of criticism and emotional intelligence and anger.
Yeah, you got so many stuff. We can talk to you for a long time, until the next win the championship. Then by that time, we'll talk to you.
Well, that would be years, my friend, years.
That was upset. But, it's been wonderful having you on board. And by the way, tell me a little more about your work. Is there anything, do you have any books or stuff you do?
Hank Weisinger,
I'll
spell it, W-E-I-S-I-N-G-E-R, PhD.com,
And do you do any workshop? Do you ever come out to LA anymore, Hank, or have you given up?
I do. There's a student version as well. And that's good for parents. It's a great graduation gift.
Okay.
Or great before their SATs.
Yeah, I can see this applicable in many areas. The students, also corporate, I would think. Even relationships, like you said, dating and things like that. So what else do you do? Do you do any personal therapy or coaching or anything these days?
Yeah, I do. Most of my time was spent in the corporate world, giving presentations. And I like to create resources and tools for people, such as the pressure class, little pamphlets and books.
Mm. That's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think we've learned a lot of wonderful things here. Basically, living a life low on pressure, I guess also high on love. You know, we talk about love here a lot, and compassion and empathy, mm-hmm. and also peace, you know, being a peaceful person, and also creative. So all these things, I think, come when we, like you said, lower our pressure in life and increase, the positive aspects, optimism, gratitude, and all those kind of good things. So again, Hank, thanks for being on the show, Dr. Weisinger. And
Thank you. I had a really good time.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So if anyone wants to write into us and get more information, ask questions about today's show, or be a guest on the show, you can reach us at lovetype4u@aol.com. That's LOVETYPE, the number 4, letter U, at AOL.com. Also our website, loveuniversity.love, and our blogs. Also, we're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Dr. Weisinger, thanks very much again for being on the show. Love University students, put away your laptops, your iPads, close everything down, and get that pressure out of your life. And go to his website and get that pressure course that we all need. Until next time, this is Dr. Avila, Love University.